A town is full of buildings, some tall, some short, some wide, and some narrow. The buildings are flats and houses, and factories and shops. They're built in streets. The streets have cars and buses, and lorries driving along them. A river runs through the middle of the town. The river has large boats and small boats on it. There's a bridge across the river so that cars and buses and lorries can get to the buildings on the other side. The cars and buses and streets are full of people. In fact, there are a lot of people in a town. Do you live in a town? Hado, Marco, and Doc live in this town.
Good day, faithless sisters, and welcome to episode 140 of the Diddly Dumb Podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc.
I'm Hayden.
And I'm Mark.
And you join us as the Radio Times has today published the results of its poll to find the most competent British Prime Minister. And it's been a surprise, hasn't it, these results? I mean, in first place, Boris Johnson. In second place, only, under 100 points behind, Theresa May. In third place, David Cameron. And in fourth place, who'd have thought this? Neville Chamberlain. In fifth place, Anthony Eden. Now, isn't it generous of voters that they've kindly forgotten the Suez debacle? In sixth place, Spencer Percival. And this is, I think this is nice how it shows that some of the classic prime ministers are coming through. He was very popular from 1809 till he was shot dead in 1812. In seventh place, John Major. In eighth place, Gordon Brown. In ninth place, Tony Blair. And in tenth place, Margaret Thatcher. So it's interesting. Now, Theresa May gets so close to, you know, first place. Do we only think she's got in second place because she's a woman? I suppose the most recent prime ministers will always get the most votes, won't they, in these polls?
Yeah, but you know what it is? It's those Boris Johnson fans just kept clicking on his name and refreshing the page because there wasn't a limit on how many times you could vote for your favourite prime minister. That's exactly how he came top.
I thought Dominic Cummings had been busy.
He has been quiet, hasn't he?
Explains why he stopped, yeah.
Yeah.
All makes sense now.
I'm not sure whether you two remember the Young Ones much. But there's a scene where...
Of course I do. What? Those two of us who were actually born when it was still on.
Well, the thing is, Doc, Mark remembers the 80s Young Ones. You remember the Cliff Richard film.
The Young Ones.
There's a scene in that when Ben Elton's on the telly talking about youth TV and then Rick Mayall ends up kicking the TV in. I nearly did that during the... it's not even a press announcement, the whatever the hell he was doing on TV the other day, Boris Johnson, when he said, unfortunately, some people haven't been adhering to the rules. I thought, wow.
The address to the nation.
Pot, kettle, black.
But changing the subject entirely, the Radio Times has also recently published a poll, the results of its poll, on the favourite Doctor. And this caused a little bit of eyebrow raising in some circles, isn't it?
Yeah, particularly around the Moffat household.
David Tennant in first place with 21%. I don't think anyone's particularly astonished at that, are they? Even if they agree with it or not. Jodie Whittaker. It's interesting, isn't it, how David Tennant probably is being carried to first place by all the females who'd like to sleep with him. And Boris Johnson's probably been carried to first place by all the females he's slept with.
I don't think they'd be voting for him in first place, to be fair, Doc, in that instance, but anyway.
Percentage-wise, Jodie's level pegging with David on 21. Barely around, just around 100 votes behind. I think that's... seems strange, doesn't it? Peter Capaldi on is third with 18%. Matt Smith is fourth with 16%. The Great Tom is fifth with 8%. William Hartnell is sixth.
Yay.
He's in sixth with 4%.
Yeah, but he got the UKIP vote, didn't he, from his portrayal in in Twice Upon a Time, you know.
What was that thing called where they decided it was the most hilarious joke ever contrived to keep saying London 1969 or something? What was the... They did the whole of the Hartnell era, didn't they?
London 1965.
Twitch. That was on Twitch, yeah.
Yeah, so I wonder if that's what boosted them up. Paul McGann in seventh.
It's... before we go any further, this is a load of bollocks.
I know.
It really is. Because... And I think we said this on our last podcast. Well, I certainly did anyway. David Tennant has a lot of fans for David Tennant in general. It's not so much his portrayal of the Doctor, who I think we all said last time out is a bit of a dick on occasions. He is a very popular actor who is in a lot of things. And I think he just picks up fans from all of these things and they just automatically think he's the best Doctor. In the way that everyone thinks that Tom Baker's the best classic Doctor. You know, those two seem to always be like a default vote. And I think it was Morgan Jeffrey, who works for the Radio Times, said that it's clearly people just voting, then refreshing the page, voting, then refreshing the page as well. Which is why he thought both David and Jodie were so high up. Personally, I'd like to see a second vote.
Another one?
You just don't believe in democracy, do you?
Do you reckon at this point, Colin Baker saw the results, just said to his wife, I'm going out, dear, and maybe sometime.
Well, he finished, it was David Tennant's father-in-law who finished last, wasn't it?
Paul McGann on seventh place with 3%. Christopher Eccleston in eighth place with 2%. That's a scandal, but it doesn't surprise me. John Pertwee in ninth. Patrick Troughton in 10th.
Oh, that's disgusting.
Sylvester in 11th place. And, Diddly Dumb Podcast. Oh, Colin! I didn't know you had our number. Oh, thank you. Yes, we thought we were just talking about that, Paul. You did what? Oh, this time you threatened to boycott the Radio Times if they didn't print the very last place. Oh, that's interesting. All right. Perhaps we'll come around and see us sometime. Okay. Bye-bye.
Do you think that Peter was at the bottom of the list and Jodie was up the top because the Jodie fans were so appalled by him saying that the Doctor should never be female?
I've heard that, yeah.
He's now been cancelled.
No, because you can't register minus votes, can you?
No, that's a good point.
You know,
yes.
I found it strange, to be honest. I mean, I suppose it's just a bit of a lottery which one ends up last. But I did feel slightly happy for Colin to see that he wasn't last for once.
It's just slightly strange, isn't it? It's, I mean, it's... I don't want to sound unkind, but Jodie being in second, it's just... I suspect, like you say, it's people stuffing ballot boxes. A weird poll. But I think
very
I suggested
weird.
On social media at one point that this may become the poll which in future years the Doctors look back on. And it will be an act of shame to have appeared at the top of it. and an act of an honourable thing to appear at the bottom of it.
I think we should get that picture of Peter Davison with the Guinness Book of Records Award and Doctor to say worst Doctor, putting the middle finger up.
Yeah, screw you, Colin.
So, what have we been up to, Hayden? You're still on your Pertwee watch, aren't you?
So yeah, so throughout the varying degrees of lockdown that we've had in this country, I've been watching different eras in order, apart from Tom Baker, which had almost no order at all. And I started off with Spearhead from Space on Monday, I think. That's a great story, that. I really, really do enjoy Spearhead. It's so different from anything else and seemed to almost become a bit of a template for introductory stories, you know, for the new Doctors after that. Especially in the new series, I find that The 11th Hour borrows quite heavily from it. And of course, Rose too. And then Silurians as well. I mean, I enjoy Silurians, but I don't think I could ever watch it in one big block. I split it up over three nights. And yeah, again, incredibly enjoyable.
That's a six-parter.
Seven-parter,
yeah. Lord, yeah.
And then Ambassadors I watched yesterday and today.
Oh, I love Ambassadors.
I mean, Ambassadors it's an odd one because it seems to be sort of a cross between Yes, Minister and The Avengers. With a little sprinkling of Quatermass in there as well.
Can you just clarify which Avengers?
Definitely not the Robert Downey Jr. and Chris Hemsworth.
Okay.
I think it's a blessed relief when they send John Pertwee into space. Because as seven-parters go, that seems to be the starting point for me. Where they start adding so much padding into this, into these longer stories. You know, the attention spans tends to wander. I got to episode 6 and I thought, well, now he's landed back. I thought, oh, okay, well, this must be wrapping up soon. And I looked at how far the DVD had to go. I still have 45 minutes left. I thought, what? How? What am I going to do now? You know, what are they going to do now? And it's interesting. But I will, I'm very much looking forward to watching Inferno next, which has always been my favourite Pertwee story. And I'm very much looking forward to seeing that. Might even watch it in one fell swoop. There you go.
Have you stopped watching them in backwards order?
Well, I only did that with Tom. I only did that with Tom because I think I did season 17, didn't I? Because I decided to give that another go to see whether, you know, Mark was... Oh, and other Mark as well, the human palindrome, whether they were just clinically insane or not by thinking it was great. And then after that, I just thought, well, I might just go backwards. So then I watched season 16, 15, 14. Obviously, the episodes in story order, but just watched the seasons back. And then when I got back to season 12, I then went to season 18, then went forward, and then couldn't bring myself to watch the Colin Baker years, unfortunately. Sorry, everyone. But then I watched Sylvester, watched Hartnell, watched most of Troughton. So now I'm watching Pertwee. But I had to stop the Troughton binge because I was waiting for a certain Blu-ray to come out. So, but I won't go back to that whilst I've got Pertwee in full swing because, you know, he's a very good doctor, even though he's, eighth in that poll or whatever. But there you go.
Yesterday I prodded people on Twitter to get some more votes in for our Seventh Doctor era, and they all flooded in within the space of a couple of hours. So that'll probably be coming up soon. What have I been doing? Not much, really. I've been doing a bit of... We're watching a few things on TV. We're watching the new... Are you being served?
Wow, what a comeback.
All Creatures Great and Small. I think it's because those recent episodes of All Creatures Great and Small on one Tuesday was about a cow being introduced to a bull. It's probably what made me think of Are You Being Served. But it's on Channel 5, and it's quite good, actually. It's at first Sam West, Timothy West's son.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Yeah. He was a bit of Siegfried. He's a bit of a, you know, over the top of a pain in the ass. I think he's calmed down a bit now. And the other's quite nice, so it's quite good. What else have I been watching?
Did you have any belated mail?
Oh, of course! Hang on. No, I've not had anything. Hang on. Was that the letterbox? Oh, it's a parcel with my name on. It's all...
Yes, it's slightly late.
It's soft and bendy. Is it banknotes? Would this be my belated birthday present from August?
Yes, it would.
Can I open it?
Yeah, go on. Why not?
Oh. I'm not aware of this.
No, it's just quite a recent one. It's from Phantom Publishing. Have you just opened it?
Oh, right. I mean, when I saw it, it was a paperback. I thought at first, oh, Christ. It's not one of Hayden's review copies, is it?
Oh, it's actually The Life and Scandalous Times of Mark John.
Oh, right. 30 years after his... Unfortunately, I can't do Uncle Terence doing blurbs off the back.
Oh, pass it here, Doc. I'll do it.
Return to the Stones, Jeremy Burnham, a long-awaited sequel to the television classic. 30 years after his experiences inside the Milbury Stone Circle as a teenager, Matthew Brake is now an astrophysicist like his father Adam before him. Recently divorced, Matthew brings his young American son Tom back to Milbury, where Adam now lives, in the manor house formerly occupied by the evil Magus Hendrick, now deceased. Despite Adam's assurances, however, it turns out that all is far from well when, soon after their arrival, Adam, Matthew and Tom are plunged into a new nightmare. Return to the Stones is a brand new sequel to the cult 1970s television series Children of the Stones. Oh, thank you very much, guys.
Well, no, it's... Have you opened it up and seen who it's from?
No. Oh, it's been signed. Dear Doc, happy day. Best wishes on your birthday. Love, Polly. Oh! In that case, I withdraw those thanks from you two.
Yes.
Oh, right.
It's from Polly because she went to Avebury back in late July, I think.
Oh, right.
And she saw that there, so picked it up for you.
Thank you, Polly. Polly, who was this week, gone off to for her first year at university, haven't they?
Yes, she has indeed.
Isn't she?
Yeah, good luck, Polly.
I've been doing some reading occasionally. One of my little fetishes is calm down, Hayden. Is
not like my trouser one, is it?
But occasionally I will seek out sort of 1940s, 1950s sci-fi. But I quite like the sort of slightly naive, or do I mean innocent, way it's written. Often the you don't have starships, you'll have rocket ships. And occasionally you'll come across ones who won't even have imagined the concept of a TV screen yet. I came across I've never read any of Robert Heinlein's before. Is he the guy who did... not Super Troopers, that's ABBA. Starship Troopers. Anyway, I came across one of his books from the 50s called Citizen of the Galaxy, it was called. And it was surprisingly good. Not surprisingly, because if I've not read him before, I wouldn't have any reason not to think that. But well worth a read. Bit of a strange ending. But a lot of very effective world building I found. But suddenly at certain stages of the book, suddenly he gets left behind and you get plunged into another world. Well worth a read, I'd say.
Yeah, I've just started reading Kurt Vonnegut's Sirens of Titan, which I had not read before.
Sirens of?
Titan.
And Kurt Vonnegut, the guy who thought that all these pyramids were built by aliens.
No. You were thinking of...
Eric von Däniken.
Yes, Chariots of the Gods.
I've got something I'd like to say, actually. Of course, you two already know this information anyway.
Oh, of course, yes.
But yes, Sophie and I are expecting a baby.
Yay!
Yes, we are. We're 16 weeks tomorrow. So it's going really well so far. It's been absolutely wonderful. Baby's doing what it needs to do. And looking forward to, well, hopefully, unless the hospital doesn't allow fathers in again, going for the scan, the 20-week scan in a few weeks. So fingers crossed.
Yeah, I wonder what's going to happen with all that as well. Everything's a bit up in the air now, isn't it? So.
Well, I mean, I suppose when you think about it, they've had 6 or 7 months to get places COVID secure, haven't they? And they are allowing, fathers are allowed in, of course they are, for the labour. you know, it doesn't really matter how long the labour takes, they're there for that. So, and also for several hours after as well, they can stay around. So that's absolutely fine. But yeah, when it came to the scans, it was ridiculous, really. But I think it was all down individually to the hospitals. I think that if the hospitals thought that they hadn't had, if they didn't have the right sort of PPE or they didn't have the right, you know, like it was like the guards that they put up and stuff like that, you know, what are they called? The Perspex glass, sorry, not glass.
Yes, the screens.
Yeah, that's it. They didn't have that at the time put up in the scan, like waiting area, basically. And that's the reason why they weren't allowing fathers in. So anyway, yeah, so thankfully now it's something which has been, you know, turned around. So yeah, so long may it hopefully continue.
Does Sophie listen to the podcast, Hayden?
No, she doesn't.
Right, so
she
has... I don't need to delete your line, your very risky line. It doesn't matter how long the labour takes.
Oh, so not in that sense. Oh dear.
Yes, Hayden has been sending Mark and me on our phones little pictures of the scans. And it does look like almost like a promo for Terror of the Zygons.
Oh,
you know what I mean? How with a very large forehead and everything.
Yeah, well, everything. I mean, it's interesting because we went for one scan where the midwife said, "Oh no, well, I'll book you in for then because you'll definitely be 12 weeks." And it turned out that Sophie was actually 9 weeks, and obviously at 9 weeks, the baby is practically still an embryo. So that so much changed within the space of 3 weeks. It was incredible. Yeah, and now baby keeps growing, and in 4 weeks' time, we'll find out whether it's going to be a boy or a girl as well. So. We've already got a nursery chair. We've already got the library's coming along very well for the baby as well. Got a little Paddington Bear toy. So yeah, we'll be getting it all decked out. So all good.
Have you seen the Paddington films?
Yes. Yeah, they're lovely.
Have you, Mark?
No.
Oh, they're astonishingly good.
Yeah, they are good.
And amazingly, the second one's even better than the first.
Mm.
Right, well, I suppose we'll have to... is there a colour midway between blue and pink? So I think we're going to have to start wallpapering the nursery on the on the third floor of the museum, aren't we?
I mean, it would be good if we could maybe get on with that soon with a TARDIS mobile and a crib which is bigger on the inside.
Well, talking about a TARDIS being on the end of a string,
what a segue!
What a segue!
Not segue, just did a runner there. It's completely gone.
Oh, we've been watching Fury from the Deep, haven't we, chaps?
We have. Mm. Yes, we have.
Fury from the Deep, the DVD or Blu-ray that has come out within the last week or so. The completely missing sixth story from the fifth season of Doctor Who, originally broadcast in 1968, written by Victor Pemberton, directed by Hugh David, produced by Peter Bryant. What did we think of it?
Mark, did you want to go first, or?
It's funny. I watched this a few years ago on my rewatch of all the Patrick Troughtons.
As a recon.
Yeah, I watched everything that was missing as a recon, and some stories worked better than others. This one, I found, although it felt too long, it felt like it had too many people in it to work as a recon. Did you remember we often bring up that thing of the massacre, trying to watch the massacre recon, which has so many characters just sitting around in those static photographs, and it's hard to tell exactly who's talking to who, and it's quite difficult to follow. I felt a little bit like that when I watched this first time around as a recon, but there's enough bits in the story that really I found quite affecting, and that made me want to see what this would look like as a proper story with moving pictures, because I felt that it would be hugely improved. And I'm not sure it was. Strangely. I just found this strangely static. I watched the colourised version, by the way. Oh, the colour version, sorry.
Mm.
But not that makes any difference. But yeah, I still found it didn't seem to be an awful leap. I still found it quite a static experience, even with the moving pictures. I still found it hard to follow. I don't know if that's just because I've got a lot going on at the moment. So my brain's perhaps a bit overloaded with other stuff. But I kept forgetting what characters were called. I just, and it went on for so long. There's so many huge, long talking bits that my mind did wander quite badly.
Interesting. Did you watch this in one big block, Mark?
Yes, I did.
Ah, okay.
I wonder if I shouldn't have done, to be honest, because I think I would have appreciated it a lot better. Because I was trying to think back to the Macra Terror, which I watched relatively recently. And unfortunately, I didn't have it available for me to look at to compare it. But I remember watching the Macra Terror and finding it far more engaging. But I'm just wondering if that's the story quality or if that is anything to do with the animation. Because I don't remember ever when I sat watching the Macra Terror, I don't remember at any point sitting there thinking, oh, this bit's going on a bit too long. It never felt like that to me. Whereas I'd say even just a few minutes into the first episode of Fury from the Deep, I was thinking, oh, this already feels like it's dragging.
Hmm.
I'm not entirely sure what you mean by static still.
As in, it didn't feel like a huge leap from watching a still image to watching a drawing of the characters being lightly animated. I mean, the faces, the artwork on the faces is excellent, but it didn't feel like there was a lot of motion going on.
This is interesting because I've had a completely opposite experience with this story.
Yeah.
I think splitting it up has helped because Mark's right, because I watched the Faceless Ones in one fell swoop. And I think after, you know, coming hot on the heels of Macra, which is a four-parter and it's quite fun and it's quite quite vibrant, isn't it, with its artistic suggestions. I think that one is very much tricky to watch as a one story because I think it's the fault of the story. I don't think it's the fault of the animation. I think that story's just too long for six parts. So I thought when this one came out, and the same with the recently re-released Power, I thought, no, I'm going to break it down. I'm going to watch a couple of stories and a couple of episodes a night because two episodes back together is kind of the 45-minute mark, isn't it, that we have now with the current series. So I did that. I watched the colour version as well. And this isn't one which I have watched as a loose canon recreation. And I have listened to it. I have listened to the audio version. But I remember that being quite ropey. I don't think I ever had it on CD. So I must have just listened to it on YouTube or something, I reckon. And I remember it being incredibly ropey. But I knew that the story came with sort of a pre-existing fan exception. That it's a classic. It's a lost Troughton story, you know. So I decided I'll watch a couple of episodes a night over a 3-night period. And I loved it. I thought it was brilliant. I thought they've put a lot more emotion into the characters' faces this time round. I thought the style of animation, which I know I brought up an episode or two ago, was going to be different from what they've done with Macra Faceless and Power. And they do kind of have more of like a thick outline on the characters. Kind of as you used to have with things like Huckleberry Hound, you know, those kind of old Hanna-Barbera cartoons.
What's that called? It's called, they started doing it on certain computer games, didn't they?
Yes, yeah, I can't remember. Yeah, but it's, but I enjoyed that. I thought that brought it to life more. And also, we're sort of led to believe that the fifth season is just a base under siege every story. And the more that we get to know about season five with the more that's either been rediscovered in the cases of the enemy of the world and Weberfear less such with my point, but I'll get on to that. And Fury, you know, now having this animated story is that these stories aren't just taking place in one spot, in one location. You know, they go off to the Harris's bungalow. They go back, they even go halfway through the story, they even go back to the TARDIS and spend an episode, you know, running experiments on the weed. You know, I didn't know that they did that at all. I think this must be the only example of a Troughton story where they actually go back to the TARDIS. So it's a wonderful, it felt more expansive, you know, with all those things put together. And also, it did another great thing where it had something which I never realised it did, but it sort of sows the seeds of Victoria's departure as early as episode one, to the point that when the story finishes, I mean, the story effectively finishes about 10 minutes into episode two. Sorry, episode two. The story effectively finishes 10 minutes into episode six, and then the second half, I meant to say, of episode six is completely given over to Victoria's departure. And I thought it was lovely. It was just nice, because we always feel like the classic series didn't really deal very well with companions' departures, you know. Well, of course, there are some exceptions, you know, Joe Grant, and obviously when Jamie and Zoe leave, I think it's quite touching and what have you. But we always tell, you know, they either get, if they're a female companion, they would get married off to someone they've just met, or they've just quite tepid departure scenes. But this one was actually, I thought...
It's lovely, actually.
You know, quite touching.
It's a really good scene. Yeah, you're right, it is seeded all the way through. This is one of the things that I thought when I first originally saw the story, even on the reconstruction. The lines are beautifully written and delivered wonderfully. I don't think it overplays the emotion at all. And there's something very sweet and quite subtle about Patrick Troughton's, Second Doctor's final words of the story, which is, I was quite fond of it too, Jamie.
Yeah.
It's redone. And they do manage to convey the emotion with the faces, which I think are really well drawn.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, there's a lot more expression, I found, wasn't there, this time round, which we didn't quite get before.
No, it's a lovely departure scene, and it makes sense. It feels right. It doesn't feel like a cheat, does it? It feels...
No.
You know, Victoria always was kind of highly strung, and she has just had an incredibly distressing time. And if you think about it, that's just... at some point, you're just going to say that I've just had enough. This is awful.
Yeah.
So, Jamie obviously just loves it. He doesn't care, does he? He just keep going.
No. No, but he's also got blind faith that whatever's wrong, the Doctor will always sort it out.
Yeah. Yeah, he has.
I've long thought that Victoria ought to be highly strung.
Oh. Doc whom? So go on then, Doc. What did you make of it?
Well, I'm afraid my opinion was similar to Mark's. It didn't help, but I can't work out whether I chose to watch this during a time when I was feeling sleepy, or whether the one was the result of the other. But I kept nodding off during it, and there reached a point where I had less and less, I don't know, animation. What's the word I'm looking for?
Motivation.
Well, thank you. Less and less motivation to rewind to when I last saw it. I thought to myself, because this episode and Wheel in Space, the next episode, have always been missing. I was unaware this was the episode where Victoria left. And so I was quite shocked when I saw it happen towards the end of the final episode. And I was thinking, oh, that's all of a sudden, they've not trailed that, have they? And then I'm not finished yet. And then I realised that they had. I think I'd just been slept through most of those incidents.
Oh, right, okay. You're forgiven then, Doc.
Why do I listen to other fans? You know the sort of fans who complain when they colourise something? Even if they still give you the original black and white version. I foolishly watched this in the black and white version. Wish I'd done the colour version. The black and white version looks a little too like Mary, Mungo and Midge. Oh, by the way, you know this... you're trying to find out what the animation is called when they use thick lines. It's called thick line animation.
No, there's a different word that I was trying to find. But
I mean, in some ways, the animation is more impressive than the Lost original. The TARDIS lands on the water. That it looks far more impressive the way they've animated it than the existing clip we see of the TARDIS landing on the water. I would have loved to have seen them through them in the dinghy. Rowing to the shore. That bit on the shore is quite Enemy of the World, isn't it? Now, in Enemy, the Doctor gets out of the TARDIS and starts capering along the beach, kicking his heels behind him. Well, here they do this thing where they're fighting with foam and dumping Victoria into the foam, which apparently, I think according to the sort on the commentary, was actually an ad-lib, I think. I don't think that was part of the script, but they kept it in because it seemed a nice moment. In a way, animation is never going to be entirely successful. I can't think of any animated ones, really, that really entertain me that much. It's always going to be flat, because it wasn't originally recorded or designed for the animation. And it can only really be, therefore, a visual cue for what you're listening to. I've said before that I can't just listen to audio soundtracks of missing episodes without something to watch, which is what. And to be fair, the recons were enough of a pain watching those with audio. It just didn't catch me. Anyway, which is strange because I thought some characters are quite forceful. But I didn't actually think that Jamie looked very much like Fraser.
No, no, he possibly didn't. As likenesses go, that was one of the worst ones, wasn't it? I'd forgotten that Van Lutchen was John Abernary as well.
Who's been everywhere.
Yes.
I thought Robson, the guy with the badger haircut, was quite good. I mean, he was ranting a bit too much. But then you always get someone doing that, don't you, in Based Under Siege ones. And let's be honest, Based Under Siege situations, pretty much, apart from, obviously, time on the beach, they pretty much have to survive on the characters, don't they? If the characters aren't there, there's not much else to distract you from it being a bit boring. And there's only so much I can take of a character who starts ranting, no, you can't do that, you can't do that, no, you can't do that, how dare you, you know, have a different opinion than me. Although I didn't realise that Victor Madden, who plays Robson, was Milchman from Carry On Spying.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. You're right.
Yeah. I found slightly amusing when I checked up on it. There's an enormous filmography.
He's also, Sid James's right-hand centurion in Carry On Cleo as well.
That's it. Yes, I was trying to work out who he was. Miss Jones.
Miss Jones?
She's quite a ballsy character. But again, I don't think there's much to get hold of, really. I think it's possibly a pity that the baddie here is tendrils of seaweed. Right, you know, there's no monster to animate. Maybe that fits in with what you were saying about there not being much movement.
Yeah, I would say, actually, that one of the great successes of the animation, probably for me, would have been the seaweed zombies sort of versions of the characters. I thought they looked great.
Yes, towards the end.
Yeah.
I thought that when the five of them sort of rose out of the foam towards the end, although I think this is part of the... There's been a fair amount of dramatic license taken with the animation. I understand that originally it was just the one character who rose out of the foam, but they thought, oh, we might as well do five. Like the... I was thinking when the helicopter was swerving through the... You know, the enormous tendrils of seaweed that came out of the sea and trying to hit it.
Oh, I loved that scene.
I was thinking, how on earth did they do this originally? But apparently they didn't. They just invented that. It was originally a very long scene of comedy scene of Patrick Troughton badly flying a helicopter.
Yes, I was surprised at that because when I watched the reconstruction, it's basically just pictures of Patrick Troughton with a funny look on his face sat in the cockpit of a helicopter with them all going, whoa, hey! And I think they even spin the photograph round at some point so that they say, oh, no, I didn't know you could do a loop-de-loop in a helicopter.
Yeah, I couldn't understand what the point of that loop-de-loop thing they kept talking about was.
But yeah, when I suddenly saw these tentacles sweeping, peering out of the sea, trying to snatch the helicopter out of the air, I was like, wow, I don't remember this bit. And I did think, I wonder how they'd managed to do this, but that scene probably went on for about 2 days too long as well, didn't it, really?
Yeah.
But I actually really enjoyed the animated scene there. I thought it was really good. I quite enjoyed the fun of it. You know, it was fun, but it was also something which was lacking from the original, I suppose, from what you said anyway, Mark, is that that was lacking peril. And there's peril and there's fun hand in hand with that scene now, which I rather enjoyed. When it comes to these animations, I think the gratitude that I feel that there are people going to great lengths to do them outweighs me trying to find too many holes in them, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Because I know now that they've got rid of the tartan pattern on the Doctor's trousers, haven't they? Because they were too difficult to animate, apparently, first time around. Jamie's got quite a static tartan kilt on now, which is a bit confusing because I don't know why they can't just do a similar pattern on Troughton's trousers. Troughton's trousers. There you go. Coming to a high street near you. Not certain about that, and I know in the past we've moaned as well about them not doing certain scenes and omitting them because they were apparently too difficult to animate.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, you can grumble about those, I suppose, but I just think there's so much love that goes into these, and it's just so great that we get to have some form of visual representation of them now that I can't find too much in. I mean, I'm watching them as cartoons. I'm not watching them as the original. It's a bit like, do you remember Star Trek, the animated series?
Yeah.
Back in the 70s. Do you remember the 70s, guys? I mean, obviously, this is stuff which was repeated for me a lot further along down the line. But I'm just treating them a bit like that. You know, they're almost like, they're just cartoons with the original actors doing the voices. Do you know what I mean? Mm. I think I'm just watching them in a different way that I watch normal Doctor Who. It's bloody jarring to go from, like I said, I was doing a Troughton rewatch recently, to go from black and white live action to widescreen colour animation, one story to another. It's almost impossible to watch them in a binge watching order for these Doctors now. But, you know, taking them in the context of what they are, which is a reimagining of a lost story, I think they're brilliant. And I think this one is really, this is one of the strongest, I'd say, that I've seen. Which is interesting because I know it was Big Finish Creative who animated this. And I think prior to this, they did the worst animation. The one that you really could grumble about, which was, in my opinion, The Reign of Terror.
Mm.
But it just seems to be, they're doing so well now. And I do wonder with, I think next year they're looking at getting out Abominable Snowmen and The Evil of the Daleks, aren't they? And I wonder if they're going to split the work again, where the BBC studios, the Charles Norton division, as it were, who did Power and Macra and Faceless Ones, will do Evil, because they've obviously animated the Daleks before, and I don't know whether that'll make it easier this time around. And whether Big Finish Creative will do the Abominable Snowmen. I wonder if that's how they're going to work it this time around. Because I think now I'm watching them more and more frequently. Because these are coming out at a rate of knots, aren't they?
Yeah.
Seems every few months we're getting a new animation, you know, of an old Troughton story. So, yeah, it'd be great to see them. But and especially with this one as well, the difficulty they had with everyone being in lockdown around the world while they were making this. You know, it just, I think at a certain point they had to kind of close it all completely, didn't they? And then just effectively work from home on this. Spread across all these different countries, wasn't it? Like India, the UK, Australia, and I think it was Canada, or United States, I think, as well. I mean, God, the effort that's gone into these six episodes is extraordinary. I just loved it. I thought it was brilliant. I really did. And I thought it really backed up the kind of story that I've heard over the years. You know, I know fans over the decades have built expectations up on certain stories. And Fury was one of those where I'm like, oh no, this is, you know, this is the last classic lost Troughton story.
Mm.
It's such a shame, you know, all six episodes are missing. And from those clips as well, from the Australian censors of Mr. Oak and Mr. Quill and the seaweed creature dragging Van Leyten's under the foam. And oh, it always looks so atmospheric and so dark and so mysterious. And I think this has just been such a glorious representation of it. Yeah, just thought it was great, really. And really brought that soundtrack and what we must have seen back in 1968. It's just brought it into sort of 2020 in a way which has expanded upon it, I think, really. And, you know, just brilliant.
Yeah. When you say just watched it like you were just watching a cartoon presentation of it, without worrying too much about what the original material would have looked like. I have to say that's definitely how I approached the Macra Terror. But right. I think because I totally fell in love with that story the first time round that I experienced it, which again was through Recon, I had absolute confidence in it. And I didn't feel I needed...
Guiding into the story.
Yeah, I just knew that I loved the story, that as long as it was passable, then I'd totally enjoy it anyway.
Mm.
And sure enough, I did. And I think with this, I was hoping that I'd get more out of the animation, I think, perhaps than... And perhaps my experience of the story first time, of it dragging slightly, but me thinking this would be better if I could actually see it. Maybe the story's just not...
Well, it's the first time I'd come across this story, so I'd never read it or anything. So, I vaguely knew something about weed below the sea or something.
Mm.
And so, then you might have thought, well, in that case, I'd be more engaged by it because I'd be listening to the story. But does anything actually happen? Well, apart from the fact that the Doctor arrives, they realise that the gas is feeding the seaweed, which then tries to take them over. Does anything actually happen during the course of the story?
Well,
does it develop? much.
No, I mean, there's some spooky sort of vignettes, isn't there? So, you know, there's some little... there's the bit with Oak and Quill in Mrs. Harris's bedroom. And there's the bit... That bit where she goes down to the beach as well with Robson.
Disappears under the waves. Yeah.
I find that really disturbing. And those are the bits that still stood out, like I said last time, from the recon. Obviously, the Oak and Quill bits are even better because you actually get to see the filmed footage of Oak and Quill, which you can't hope to, because they exist, you can't hope to make them better via animation, because it just, well, it's just not going to happen. But and the bit with Van Nutschen being taken down, even that bit where he's saying there's something down there in the pipes and stuff. I think those are the bits that I took away from me the first time I watched it, and they're still the bits that stood out to me watching it this time around. But it's all the other stuff still didn't seem to come into focus for me. Yeah, and I don't think enough does happen in the 6 episodes.
Considering it's 6 episodes,
it's,
oh, let's go down the impeller shaft, let's go here, let's go there. It's been even more boring in the actual original, because they didn't even visit those rigs in the middle of the Thames, did they? Apparently that's entirely an animated thing now. I think they possibly flew over them with a helicopter. They didn't land on them or anything. I think she said Mrs. Harris's bedroom. I thought I quite like that line where Harris is saying to Robson, "My wife's very ill. She needs medical attention." And Robson says, "What's the matter with her? Because she got a hangover or something." Which I thought she was a bit. The best bit for me was Victoria's departure. I don't mean that nastily. I mean I thought it was quite well done. Quite liked how Jamie just gave her a peck on the forehead. Kiss. Did you have you listened to the commentary?
No, I haven't.
There's a story. You know that they're always telling stories about how was it her knickers that Fraser ran at the flagpole or something?
I thought that was Wendy Papery.
Yeah, that
was
Wendy Papery. But you were saying a story used to tell at conventions. People said that.
It's Deborah Watling's kilt that she undid. It fell off when she stood up.
When people used to ask about them, how they got on when they first met.
People said, how did you meet Deborah Watling? I said, well, after the Thursday rehearsals, I took her out for dinner. I went out for lovely dinner. At the end of the night, I said, you know, do you mind if I kiss you goodnight? She said, no, you must. I said, oh, Debbie, can I just one little kiss? No, Fraser, I shouldn't be in bed with you as it is.
I found quite amusing, actually.
They were quite heartbroken, weren't they, when she left, the pair of them? They were quite... I think because of the strain of the recording schedule itself as well, I think this is around the time when Pat Troughton probably started looking at the role and thinking, actually, maybe I should be leaving soon, perhaps.
How long does it go on after this? How many more series are there before...
Well, you've got one more series.
Is the next series the War Games series?
Yeah.
Well, right. Was Wendy Papery only with us for one series?
Yeah. One series and one story.
So Wheel is the final one of this series, is it?
Yeah.
I was quite amused by Robson when he was in his seaweed zombie guise, and Victoria starts screaming at him. And he's like, no, stop! Ah, no! Stop. Reeling away from that. That was quite funny.
First example of the sonic screwdriver, of course.
Yeah, and that was interesting in the documentary, wasn't it? That he actually dropped Patrick Troughton dropped the prop into the pipe. So in the end, they had to use a little pen light, didn't they? Instead.
But no, I was a little disappointed with it, to be honest.
Can I just say as another sort of one, my positive. I thought some of the lighting effects were lovely, especially in that scene where Jamie's asleep in the bunk and Victoria's trying to talk to him. And the light's coming in through there, and then Patrick comes in through the door. And I think that looks absolutely gorgeous, that the lighting effect.
But it's the story that's my problem with it, isn't it?
I'm thinking as well. It's just, there's not enough.
I don't know if that happens, really, yeah.
No.
You're all so mean. I think it definitely benefits from watching them in split up. I think it's...
Yeah.
6 parts is far too much. Far, far, far too much to watch in just one fell swoop. It's not... The attention span wanes, and it's... Yeah, I just don't think it's a very, very good way of of watching these, really.
I've watched the War Games. I've watched the War Games in one sitting before.
Yeah, but the difference with that, Mark, is that it's live action. You know, there are things going on. And one of the things that you've highlighted was you thought this was quite static, and that's because it's 2D drawings, essentially, moving around
the screen. Yeah, and I don't think what they're showing would be... I don't get the impression that the TV, that the actual footage itself would perhaps be any more animated, if you know what I mean. It's still essentially two or three people standing in that control room.
I mean, in a way, it's an improvement. That large control room looks great in the animation.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, you're right, yeah.
This, you know, the bit at the surviving clip they found in, was it 2003? Where the Doctor's clutching that accordion thing and they're all fighting the phone.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
And I'm sure it's quite tiny and cramped, that control room, isn't it? As naturally it would. Mm. But I quite like that they've decided to... Because, really, they've got nothing to go on, have they? They've not got any... We've got Episode 3 still exists. I think in that case, they should use as much dramatic license with the animation as they like.
Yeah.
And that's really... Because I was thinking, I was watching this, this is going to be a short podcast. I can't think of anything to say about it that's good. Or even that's bad. It's not that it's terrible. It's just...
Mm.
Well, you know what? We've said recently that we were starting to wonder whether we were going to watch... whether we were going to keep buying these individual Blu-rays, you know, for these older stories. Clearly, the sales boost, you know, the prospects of other stories being done.
Yes.
So for that, they are, you know, it's a good thing to get behind. But also... Something else as well is the after watching season 7 at the moment, just seeing how poor some of the quality of the look of those stories are, because they're taken from different sources. You know, I think it's with Silurians, didn't they splice together the colour from a video recording in the 70s with the black and white film copies that they had in I think it was BBC Enterprises or something. It looks okay and it looks passable on DVD and, you know, great for something that, again, brilliant effort gone into it from the restoration team. But, I mean, is that really going to look any good in Blu-ray? Are they going to make that look any better on Blu-ray? And I just think as well, like, with the extra features, like with the black and white snippets they have on the bonus disc and also with, going back to the faceless ones, you know, with the surviving episodes included as a bonus as well, they really didn't look good on a high definition disc, you know, and I just wonder whether, when it comes to the 60s material, whether they will actually bring it out on Blu-ray, and whether these will actually come out in a collection. I think we all thought as fans, oh yeah, of course they will, you know, now they'll end up coming out. It's all, but actually, I'm starting to wonder now. I think maybe with the 60s stuff, and maybe with the missing stories, this might be all that we get for them.
Mm.
Because when they all exist together, it just doesn't quite work. They exist brilliantly as what they are, but then when you add what they were or what they are representing to it, I don't know.
Oh, I also want to point out, aren't the arms on the characters incredibly long?
I know, yeah!
Yeah.
It's the length of his arms.
You know, they used to do Andrew Marr on that spitting image.
Oh, that was on Dead Ringers, wasn't it?
Dead Ringers.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right there. Yeah, okay, yeah, I can quibble over that. Yes, the arms are a little long in places. What does old Charlie Croker say in The Italian Job? Shorten the arms, I'm not a gorilla, love.
Oh, we lost Diana Rigg, didn't we?
Oh, yeah, that was a sad day.
From, what was it called? The Scarlet?
The Crimson Horror.
Crimson Horror. I quite like that one.
Yeah, and of course, Mrs. James Bond. In Honor Majesty's Secret Service and Mrs. Peel.
That's all I've got to say, really. It's a bit of a downer, this, isn't it?
No, it's all right. It doesn't matter if it's a short one. It's fine.
Yeah, I think it's okay. I think we've done all right. Just think of it this way, Doc. There's less work to do on it.
Hmm.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
No, it's there's nothing else, really, is there?
So, marks out of 10.
Oh, it's difficult because I'd not really complain so much about the animation as the story, I guess. I guess it'd be a 6.
Oof.
I think it's a 5.
Oh, God. I was going to give this an 8.5.
Oh, what can it say?
No, one's stopping me. Eight and a half for this one.
Fair enough. I still wonder how much my opinion would change if I got to see the actual story. But that's not likely to happen, is it? So.
Well, if I ever discover it, we can do a new another podcast on it. Right then.
I forgot to say that one part of this that I enjoyed particularly was when Robson started doing his Bruce Forsyth impersonation in the control room. We just go, "I'm in charge here."
I didn't.
Oh, brilliant.
Right. Uncle Terence, have you come to give us some information about the government's new lockdown rules since the Prime Minister's address to the nation this week?
Yes, I have. It's go to work but don't go to work, go outside but don't go outside, and help out the economy by eating out. No, for God's sakes, don't eat out, everyone will get ill again.
What about these bodies?
Oh, yeah, well, I mean, you can't dunk them in the river, can you? No, you can't.
Uncle Terence, we have pubs not operating table service in Sector 27.
Eat your twip.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dun Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydunpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Facebook, Audio Boo, and stitcher.com at diddlydun, on Twitter at diddly_dun, or email us at diddlydunpodcast@yahoo.co.uk. Diddly Dun, meaty, not runny. Top breeders recommend it because it's solid nourishment for the ears.